Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I don't have any comments, and if I did, I wouldn't read them today anyway, because we have some special guests with us in the studio. But let me just set this up. Now, for all of you out there reading the Paul Johnson book, we'll just push ahead here to 1924. And we've been covering some of the previous dates. But Johnson really does a good job for you of summarizing Winston Churchill's temporary restoration to power under Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin. And it was really, remember, he dropped like a rock after the Dardanelles. But when Baldwin came into power in 1924, he put Winston back into the cabinet. And, of course, he was prime minister twice, by the way. So if you're reading other books and you find out that he was in 1937, that's because it's true. He was. But in 1924, what excited Winston more than anything is he was put in the position of Chancellor of the Exchequer. Now, that's a really hard word to say, so I have to repeat it again, exchequer. But what that meant was that he was the finance minister for the United Kingdom, and that was an incredibly high and responsible position because he prepared the nation's annual budgets. Now, what excited him most about it is his father held the same position, and we know about Winston that he had such a bad relationship with his dad, but he still wanted to be like him. And so he was just enthralled to be Exchequer. Now, we know that Mr. Churchill had 5 years of really good experience, but there were some things that weren't so good. Churchill, he made some mistakes. He regretted them. He said he regretted them. Again, Johnson does a great job of this, but in 1929, when it was time for a re-election, Baldwin got the thumbs down from the British, and Mr. Churchill was out again. But typical of Mr. Churchill, he didn't let that get him down, and he decided, well, I'm just going to go out and make money on a large scale. And he was quite a wealthy guy anyway. But what he did in 1929, he came to America on a lecture and speaking tour. He was also misled into investing in the American stock market, and in 1929, he wrote home to his wife and said, "Honey, we just made a small fortune." And then a month later, he had to write home again, "Honey, we just lost it all, every bit of it." And so he was really shattered by this. And so back at home, we all know what he was a man of the empire, and there was all this controversy over giving India home rule. He knew it was a mistake. He knew that it would be a blow to the empire. He knew that it would take away the empire's wealth. He was against it. And like his dad did years before, he resigned. Instead of staying in the fight, he resigned. So, you know, I think that the loss of wealth just really, really hurt him. So, you know, that wasn't the best thing he could have done. But, you know, it's interesting. Baldwin came back into power, but Winston was away making money, and he wasn't even considered for office. As Johnson states, it was as if he lost his direction in politics. And then, if that wasn't bad enough, in 1931, he was back in America. He was back on a speaking tour. He was in New York City, and he was crossing Fifth Avenue in the dark. And so he went the wrong way. He got struck by a car, and he was really seriously hurt. I mean, he was injured in his head, his thigh, his ribs. And it really was, I mean, you talk about a blow. It was really, really bad for him. Even Johnson, this is page 87 for those of you reading Johnson, he wrote, but in the true Churchillian style, he wrote about it in an article and made like £600 on the article. So it's really pretty interesting. But here's what he wrote in the article. He says, "I certainly suffered every pang, mental and physical, that a street accident or, I suppose, a shell wound can produce. None is unendurable. There is neither the time nor the strength for self-pity. There is no room for remorse or fears. If at any moment in this long series of sensation a gray veil deepening into blackness has descended upon the sanctum, I should have felt or feared nothing additional. Nature is merciful and does not try her children, man or beast, beyond her compass. And that just proves how much Winston Churchill read from the Bible. So anyway, it was disaster, and that was the gate that Winston Churchill entered into what he called his wilderness years. And so he then, for the next 10 years, lived this decade of political isolation. Now, today, I have two special guests with me in the studio to help me talk about Winston Churchill and his wilderness years. So I want to welcome Stephen Fleury, who is host of Trumpet Daily. And I also have his son, Jude, who is a junior at our Imperial Academy, to help me do this. These guys have really been into Manchester and his works on Winston Churchill. So for the next two programs, we're going to spend most of our time using William Manchester's second volume titled Winston Spencer Churchill Alone, 1932 to 1940. Now, this book is about 700 pages, and so we can only give you just some highlights from it. But I do highly recommend you take on the challenge of reading the three-volume set. It really is an amazing piece of literature, and actually, it's just the best literature. So we got to get in there. All right, so I'm just going to turn it over to you guys. Let's just start talking about the wilderness years.
Well, first of all, we're happy to be here. This is very exciting. It's great to be a father-son tandem in support of your radio program.
Yeah, well, welcome to both of you. So.
Thanks. Yeah, it's good to be here.
Yeah, that's great.
We've read, over the past year, we went through the first and second volume with just a small group at Edstone. But this second volume, we got through mainly this summer. So it was, as you say, I mean, if you can get through all three, that would be awesome. But the second volume, I think in particular, because he's sounding the alarm during the wilderness years, as you say, and everybody's against him, and everybody in Britain wants to appease Hitler, and then I think you alluded to in your opening monologue there that he, even though he was in isolation, he was incredibly productive. And that, to me, that, as I told our little book club, that's the most inspiring part. I like the history too, obviously, all the political intrigue and who's in charge and what they're doing and how they're negotiating this or not. But anytime Manchester gets into what sort of made Churchill tick, that really always aroused my interest, because you see this very unique individual who had this unusual schedule, and yet he was so disciplined and so productive. It's just amazing to read that and see how much that man churned out, even when nobody liked him.
Right. I don't know how many people know you're actually president of Herbert W. Armstrong College as well. But Mr. Stephen Fleury and his son do live at our sister campus in Edstone, so they've been having this book club. It's kind of like an alternate book club to JBL, but that's okay. I can deal with that.
We'll have to have a phone hookup.
Yeah, that would be great. But I think that the thing is that what amazes me, just in terms of writer, and of course, Stephen knows I've been writing all my adult life, really, since I was 23. But it was during these 10 years that he wrote The World Crisis, which is four volumes, and he wrote The Marlborough History, His Life and Times, is four volumes. That's eight volumes of books.
Yeah.
And they're not like small books.
Well, right at the end, he wrote History of the English-Speaking Peoples. He was in 1938 and 1939. I think that's three or four volumes.
Yeah.
He was under a big deadline. I think there was one exchange he had with his son, who it was right as Hitler's, on the move, basically. And he, maybe you remember this, Jude, but he withdrew and said, well, as hard as it is to go off and refocus on James II, I've got to do it. I've got to go and write about this history. So here the world's about to explode, and he's just immersed in all of his downtime to try to get these volumes out. Yeah, Manchester says that during the wilderness years, I think it was from 1931 to 39, he wrote 11 books and 400 articles.
Yeah.
That's during an 8 or 9 year period. And not to mention all of the House of Commons speeches. I mean, he didn't speak as much. he wanted to sort of pick his points where he could really hit it hard, I guess. But yeah, the way he was writing articles, I mean, he was sounding the alarm throughout the 1930s.
It's just amazing. I think the thing that is really really quite fascinating is that you could get the impression. Well, one thing I think we ought to clarify is he still had a seat in the Commons. So So it's not like, you know, he was totally out of politics, but he didn't have a cabinet position.
Right.
And that's really where the guts and the glory was. And so Judah's shaking his head. So maybe I'll let you take over and let you help explain this.
Yeah. I did think the whole second volume really was the best of the three. And I thought, you know, again, with what you said on just how much he was producing during this time, you know, all of the 11 volumes of books that he was writing, I thought just the best passage of the best volume of this series was right as Hitler is about to invade Poland. And Manchester does this very effective, he's using his language really effectively. He does this contrast where he'll write maybe three or four paragraphs about, you know, how Hitler is invading and he's coming and Britain needs to be preparing, but they're not. And then he'll write, you know, a couple of paragraphs about how Churchill is in his study, meanwhile writing History of the English-Speaking Peoples. And at the same time, if you read them side by side, you know, the first one is like, well, that's a little random. But then you get to the second one, and he's writing, you know, Churchill's writing about, you know, King Arthur and Elizabeth I and the Spanish Armada defeat and Roman England and all this stuff. And each time it kind of draws another parallel with the modern history that's taking place. So aside from being just awesome history and biography that he's writing, it's also extremely well written, and he really knew what he was doing, and it's just kind of the two stories are very well interwoven. So if you were going to read any pages of this book, at least in my edition, it's 509 to 513. Those were at least what I thought were the best.
I remember when he was always a little bit ahead of us.
Yes.
And so he would, I remember when he first went through that section and he came in and he's like, Dad, it's great history, obviously, but this part is just really well written. And he was just really impressed with the drama that Manchester put in that part, where, as he said, you know, you have all this exciting history happening in 1939, and then he brings up history that Churchill was writing about Lord Nelson or Queen Elizabeth or whoever,
right,
which was very inspiring too. And as I've been speaking here over the last few days with the college students, I mean, you can see how, I think Manchester was trying to make this point, that you can see how history was his counselor. I mean, it was his guide. He drew inspiration from the history of the British Empire, and that's what motivated him, right, and that's what informed his decision-making and all those things. So I think Manchester does a really good, like my father has said, he does a really good job of capturing the drama of that history of the wilderness.
Yeah, it's definitely not boring biography at all.
No.
But the thing is, honestly, I feel like, of course, you know, as your father would recommend that we do this on the radio, and I just can't get away from it. There's so much there. I know we're going to have to move on. Poor George Washington is like, they've been waiting for months for George Washington. It's like, wow, we're still in Churchill. But I feel like I've been changed by reading the books.
Yeah.
And it's like, man, we can all do more.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't even get depressed. I mean, he I'm sure he was down, but even his wife helped him with some of that.
Yeah.
But he just went to work.
Yeah. That is amazing. I mean, he had his bouts, I guess.
He
called it the black dog when
right.
he would slip into depression. But I think you're right. He pulled himself out of it by working. I mean, he didn't have God's spirit.
Right.
You know, he didn't understand God's plan. But he got his mind off of it. I mean, we talk about that in the church at times about, you know, just a change, you know, changing
right.
your thinking if you get into a negative mindset.
Right. Well, anyway, it to me, the thing that I think amazed me is that he and his wife together, and we just finished some programs about her and how she was really helpful to him. And a lot of times she disagreed with him, but would never disagree with him publicly. You know, she didn't want to embarrass him because she really knew his genius. She really knew he was a genius. But he really never stopped serving the nation, even though he was out of a cabinet position, kind of out of the limelight, kind of out of favor, because everyone hated him. I mean, we know that. But he still was very concerned about the nation. I mean, he didn't go away and sulk, but he was still reading and studying. And he knew, I mean, there was this, the impact of World War One. I thought Manchester does a great job of bringing that out, how it just devastated the economies of Britain and France. Mm-hmm. You know, and of course they were trying to make the Germans just pay for it all, which was like a near impossible task anyway, because there was just billions of lives, or millions of lives lost, and there's billions of dollars, and there was these widows, you know, there's childless families. I mean, we know the impacts of that. And then, of course, the pacifist movement starts coming in, the anti-war movement, and then you have the flood of the communists mm-hmm. coming in. And so, but he stayed on top of all of that during this time period. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we could talk a little bit about that. I thought it was amazing how Manchester brings out the rise of immorality at the time. And he calls Berlin the modern Babylon, which, by the way, is pretty good apt description of Germany, you know, anyway. But there were food riots, there was unemployment, and unfortunately the British Empire was waning. Yeah. I mean, that's some really bad stuff that were going on going on. And of course we're after World War II babies, and we've only known good things.
Yeah. You know, that's not to venture too far away from what you're mentioning there, but if you go to the first volume, that's what's really fascinating about that one, is because he really was born into the empire at its peak back in 1874. And this was when, you know, when he got to be in his teens, this was when, you know, the late 1890s, this was when British, you know, youths, male youths were eager to go and fight for empire. They were eager to go on some adventure somewhere around the world where the empire was spreading. And like you said, then you get into the years following World War One, and all those young boys slaughtered in the trenches.
Millions.
And the pacifist movement set in following that war, and then the, you know, the strictures put upon Germany and the Treaty of Versailles, they were, you know, burdensome. And then of course Hitler capitalized on that to build up his army and rebel against it. But then the Allies didn't do anything to really enforce it. Churchill was, he didn't really agree with the, like, some of the things in the Treaty of Versailles, but if it was Germany that of course took advantage of that and their warmongering spirit once Hitler came on the scene.
Yeah. But you know, it's to me, and you guys can jump in here too, but to me it just seems like, okay, we talk about Churchill, and he was definitely a student of history. And I think all of us try, and you just need to find the right books to get the right history. But the thing is, it's happening all over again.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got communism just rampant in the Democratic Party in this country. We have Germany rising again. And it's like no one wants to see there could be evil lurking behind what's happening in Berlin, and what's happening behind the big, you know, new gas pipeline from Russia. And really, it's only us at the Trumpet, Trumpet.com, Trumpet Daily. It's only us that are really saying it's a bad thing. And the thing is, it is, to me, it's just a really clear, sharp message that history does repeat itself.
Yeah.
And it's just shocking, you know, what's happening. I think it's interesting how Manchester talks about when the communists came in, they see all the food riots. And of course, he makes the comment about English society, that actually the English classes are satisfied with where they are if they have enough food and if they have enough of what they need. But after World War One, it became so bad economically, they didn't get food, they didn't get what they needed, so they began to riot. And well, then that's when communists saw their opening. And then they entered the labor movement. And he was against the labor movement because of some of that. Of course, you know, he had to deal with the strikes in Scotland. And he had to send in the troops, and they didn't like him for that. But he was right about some of that. And so here, and then he says that it was the, Granny Glass's intellectuals, you know, they got into the communism, and they get in, and they see the riots coming, so they get into the labor people, and they kind of infiltrate them, and that's exactly what's happened in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was really interesting with, I guess, a lot of conservative economists today will point out that communism really was just a fallacy from the start, or at least, you know, Marx believed in it, but he knew that he couldn't argue his theory against the economists of the day. So he instead came up with his class theory, which was, you know, each person in their class has a certain way that they think, and so if you're from this class, then your opinion is less valid than if you're from, you know, if you're a poor person or whatever. It's the same stuff that we see going on today, and Churchill was like the only one that saw through that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's kind of astounding that it gained so much just support among the intellectuals, because they were the ones that Marx was worried about that wouldn't adopt it, and they just totally went in hook, line, and sinker. It was just all in for communism once things got bad.
Right, but then there were enough conservatives that got really concerned about communism, and even Churchill made the comment: "You put one Soviet in London, and the empire's gone." You know, he knew how it could spread like a germ, you know, or like a plague. What's amazing to me is they became afraid of the Soviets, or the Reds, they called them. So they were going to start cozying up to Germany,
right,
to be the, right, I guess, the cannon fodder to stop them from coming into Britain.
Yeah, and he has all this section about how in the West End of London, Nazism became fashionable, and even Hitler's hairstyle, of all things, that they started to just become infatuated with Hitler, thinking that Nazism would sort of serve as a bulwark against the spread of communism.
Yeah. To me, that's just unbelievable. But again, only Winston Churchill was out alarming people against Hitler.
Right. As yeah. early as, I think, even before Hitler became the chancellor, 1931 or 32.
Yeah, he knew it.
And then certainly when Hitler came in 1933, Churchill was saying, you know, Mein Kampf is essential reading. If you want to see where this guy is going, you better read his manifesto. And nobody, I mean, if they did read it, they didn't take it seriously, no. But it was all laid out there.
But Winston Churchill read it and believed it.
Yeah. And he read it. I think Manchester brings out that he read it as soon as it came out. This was in the 1920s. I think 24 was when he wrote it. And Churchill, being the voracious reader that he was, and obviously he was watching world events as well, he devoured it right away. And then he has all this insight into what Hitler's going to do only because he read what Hitler said he was going to do.
He believed him. That everyone, I think, really thought that Hitler was just a joke. Yeah. He was like the German Charlie Chaplin. But anyway, it's just, in some ways I feel a little, I mean, I'm really glad we really are getting into this, but in some ways I feel like I'm a little late in my life to be knowing this, you know, but at least I know it now, you know. And it's like I've never had a real mind for history and remembering it, but boy, I can remember this because I think, you know, I had parents that lived through it. I have, you know, yeah. My parents lived through the Depression. My mother would talk about, I mean, I do have an uncle. I came from old family. I do have an uncle that fought in Flanders Field. You know, my Uncle Harry, I never knew him because he was dead before I was born. My mother was 13 out of 13. I was 6 out of 7. So I'm pretty much down the line.
Right.
And so we heard of these things. I mean, my parents would watch, you know, the films of the Germans, you know, the jackboots, and I would be terrified as a young person. And then, of course, we'd have the atomic bomb tests, and we'd be terrified. But, you know, no one's terrified today.
No. They're too busy looking at their iPhone.
Yeah.
I'm the same as you. I feel like I've started on this, just immersing myself into it a little late. But the exciting thing is with, you know, the interest you're stirring up and then what we're doing at Edstone. Even Jude was saying the other day that since we're here at Edmond, he says just in walking through campus, he's seen like 20, 20 copies of the Churchill, the Manchester.
Everyone has one.
Yeah, because you know, we've been promoting it so much, and my father keeps reinforcing
it
as well.
Mr. Hilliker's helping.
Yeah, and now Mr. Hilliker's got the book club reading it here in Edmond, so you see all these copies of Manchester's work all over campus, and a lot of them are being read by, you know, people who are in their 20s or like Jude in their teens.
Yes. Well, I hate to say this, but guess what, guys? We're coming to be out of time for this program.
It's too short. You need an hour-long show.
I know. That's what your son
That's what I have.
I just want to thank you both for coming in today. And but that's all the time we have for today's program. But next time, we will continue our discussion of Churchill's wilderness years. But we're going to talk a little bit now about the solace that he gained from his beloved estate, Chartwell. So the next book in this series is also by Paul Johnson. It's titled George Washington, Founding Father. Our third book in the series is Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence Arabia. Remember, you can find both books on Amazon. You can also find used copies of books at apebooks.com. And I've gotten some great books for really low cost. Now, of course, you can always check your local library. Someone reminded me about that. Don't forget about the libraries. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl at pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. Streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.